trade. It's simple, folks. Saving and selection adds up to your satisfaction. So drive Route 14, 15, or 16 to Hardwick and the final days of the Find Your Way to Savings event happening now at Lamoille Valley Ford.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A beautiful day out there today. Thanks for spending part of it with us. Forecaster Roger Hill says we got forecast for the next 2 days are in the 80s. Gotta love that. Pretty nice weekend, too. Thanks, Rog. Appreciate that. Don't worry, we'll all have plenty of time in the winter to for payback. All right, coming up on the program today, in our second hour this morning, right actually at the top of the hour at 10, we're gonna, I've asked Victoria to join us a little bit early today from Talk Radio News Service. We're going to be joined by a guy named Rich Harwood, who does work with communities. He is, I would describe him as a community healer. He has worked in a bunch of places, including Newtown, Connecticut, where there was the terrible school shooting. He was down there within days of that incident, trying to help that community get back together again. So I thought it might be helpful to have him join us with this story out of Ferguson, Missouri, which I know seems a little remote to us here in little old Vermont, but wow, I mean, this is a huge story with just huge implications. So Rich will join us coming up at the top of the hour. We would welcome your phone calls as well. You are welcome to reach us at the usual phone numbers, 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. We're going to begin this morning on a troubling increase here in the state of Vermont, and that is in the number of child abuse cases. And it really is really quite discouraging. Laura Krantz of Vermont Digger had a piece about a week or so back talking about the increase that has happened in child abuse cases in the past year. This was looking at data comparing fiscal year 2014 and 2013. And if you actually go back even further than that, I'll give you some of the numbers on this as we go along here. But it is dramatic. And it's not, this isn't, I don't think we're talking about something that's just a fluke here. So I asked T.J. Donovan, who's the Chittenden County State's Attorney, to join us this morning, and maybe we can get some better idea of what on earth is going on out there. And T.J., thank you very much for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, Mark. Thanks for having me.
You've described this as an unprecedented run of child fatalities that you're dealing with up in your county. There have been four kids who have died. One case I know is still under investigation. So what do you think is going on?
Well, the short answer is I really don't know. Obviously, it's incredibly troubling. Three of the four deaths that you just referenced occurred in Chittenden County. Two have been charged. One is currently under investigation. The common thread in all these cases seems to be a history of drug abuse and addiction with either the parent or the caretaker. And, of course, that I think people can understand that, given how much dialogue we're having in this state about the opiate epidemic. And I do think, obviously, there is some relation there. But we have to do a couple of things in order to keep kids safe, in my opinion. Number one, we need more reporting to DCF. And not only do we need more reporting, we need earlier reporting. And I'm talking prenatal care reporting, when mom is pregnant. You know, right now, Mark, as it stands, if you have a question about a mother who is pregnant and say she's 6 months pregnant and she may be using drugs, or you may have a suspicion that she's using drugs, if you make that call to DCF saying mom is pregnant, is on drugs, unless mom is 30 days out from her due date, DCF will not accept that call. And I can certainly understand the policy behind that in terms of, you know, whether or not there's a person or whatnot. But let's put that issue aside and just say, hey, look, let's deploy those services to mom. Let's make sure that there's prenatal care. Let's make sure that mom has the option of getting into treatment. So when baby is born, baby is healthy. Mm. Because this doesn't happen overnight. This happens, this is about health care and delivering those services during the pregnancy of women who may be addicted to drugs. We also have to work with the medical community to make sure, as I said, that there's more reporting. I understand the tension between doctors and patients, but, you know, I can tell you that I'm somewhat troubled in some of these cases that reports were not made earlier to DCF from medical professionals when examining and documenting what appears to me pretty clear cases of abuse. So we need more reporting. We need earlier reporting. I'm not putting this all on DCF. They have an incredibly difficult job. I think that we can build the infrastructure in our communities. If we can't, you know, let's make that change from the 30 days out from due date, that we deploy other team members to mom to make sure that we get two things. Number one, prenatal care, so babies are healthy when they're born. This is the key. Secondly, make that option of treatment available to mom during the pregnancy, because, you know, we do have, as I said, that common thread of addiction here in these cases, and more babies, I think that's been documented, being born addicted. And mm-hmm. so we really have to be, again, out in front of this and have really meaningful, robust intervention earlier in time.
I want to get back to this reporting thing you're talking about here in a minute, but I'm not clear on something.
Yep.
The connection between child abuse and opiate addiction is what? I mean, it's not that people who are using heroin are violent and likely to abuse
right.
their child. What is it?
You know, I don't know. The cases that we're seeing, obviously the facts are unique to each individual case. I don't know. And, you know, Mark, I think you're right in that statement that I don't think we can say there's an increase because you use heroin or whatnot that you're more violent. I think it's perhaps the larger issues of all these different pressures being put upon parents, and then you couple that with this issue of addiction and whether or not you're using or not using, and the stress of trying to get your drugs, or your stress of trying to get treatment, the stress of trying to withdraw. And I think all those stressors may compound, and then of course you get a trying baby. And I think, look, I think you talk to any parent, there's no parent alive who hasn't found themselves in a moment of stress, right? You may be the most calm and rational person in the world. When you get a two-year-old crying, it's a stressful event. And so how do we teach these parents to be good parents, to build these coping skills that you don't use violence and you don't abuse your child in an effort to make them go to sleep or to be quiet, you know? So this is also about parenting. You know, parenting has often been said the most difficult job there is on earth, and I can attest to that. But how do we lead people to be good parents? How do we teach them to be good parents? I know this. It gets a lot more complicated when you're talking to somebody who's addicted to drugs.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at, I think, is that it's this sort of it's the stress. It's the one thing that puts somebody over that line.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've all been there. You know, with young kids, you know, that you're tired, you're frustrated, and this is I'm just speculating here, Mark. I don't have any answer, but you know, you got somebody who's using drugs, who can't get to treatment or who can't find their fix. And I got to think that they're on edge to begin with. They don't have good coping skills. They don't have good parenting techniques. And unfortunately, I think all this stuff leads to these really tragic situations because, again, as I said, the common thread that I'm seeing is a history of drug abuse mm-hmm. in these cases.
And your self-esteem is in the toilet, too.
Absolutely, you know, and it's just shocking to me because to see what happens to some of these children, I don't think anybody who is in their right mind could ever fathom doing this to a child. Of course, the operative word being in your right mind. I mean, you know, obviously when you're under the influence of drugs or addicted, you're not. And it's not making excuses. I think it's trying to get at the heart of the problem. And for me, looking at these cases, we have to have earlier intervention with mothers who are pregnant. We're waiting too long if we're waiting for the child to be born, Mark. We need prenatal care across the board to every woman who is carrying a child. That's going to make the difference here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not waiting until they're born. It's making sure that when they're born, they're healthy.
Mm-hmm. But talk about a can of worms, TJ. You mentioned it. You referenced it earlier before. But, boy, you start getting into reporting women who are pregnant before the child's born. Mm-hmm.
I understand the political argument on that. But at the end of the day, we're talking about protecting kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the medical evidence is pretty clear that prenatal care is a critical component to having healthy kids. And it's really not only having healthy kids. When you look at kind of all the evidence across the board, when we talk about early education and early intervention, people talk about 0 to 3. I mean, let's draw it a little bit earlier. Again, that prenatal care, and we're talking the investments at this point in time really pay dividends for somebody's the rest of their lives.
Right.
And so this is what we have to get to. But that means we need earlier reporting, we need more reporting, and we need the medical community to I get it from the medical community. You want to do the best for your patient, and you got to work with them. But we got to build, I think, the infrastructure in this state, and we have to build the willingness that you have to report when there's a question. When in doubt, report it out, because we can't afford to see another child die. We can't afford to see another kid be severely abused. Mark, we talked over email last week about a case that resolved last week in Chittenden County, another child abuse case where the child will probably never walk again because of the abuse that she suffered. That's just unacceptable. And you can't turn back the clock here, but going forward, we got to make sure that there is a coalition of willing participants from law enforcement, from social services, from the medical community, working in the best interest of all our children, because that really is going to be the test of who we are as a community and as a state. What do we do to protect the most vulnerable in this state, and who is more vulnerable than a child?
Talking with T.J. Donovan, the Chittenden County State's Attorney. Help us understand what happened with that case I was asking about last week.
Sure.
It was a sentence of 6 to 15 years, and the judge suspended all but 30 months, so 2.5 years in jail for crippling a child.
That's right, and in full disclosure, Mark, that was a plea agreement agreed to by our office. And why we did that is because we didn't have the evidence. To be perfectly blunt, mom, the mother of the child, was going to testify on behalf of boyfriend. That is a sad commentary in a lot of different ways, but that is the reality of what we were facing in that case. And we wanted the long supervision, which we're going to get on the 6 to 50, and we wanted a punitive component, which we're going to get for the 2.5 years. Is it long enough? Not really, but it's better than walking away with an acquittal. And when the only other person in the house at the time was mom, was going to testify for the defense, that raises some challenges for us. And that's the reality of this building.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of the business we're in, is, and we are always flabbergasted when we're looking at oftentimes different parents choosing the side of the charged parent over the child.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to say that is a unique and limited circumstance. Unfortunately, I'm not so sure it is. And that's really disturbing.
Ken Bickard had this piece where he interviewed a shaken baby expert. So, there's not only these deaths that are going on, but also there are, an increase in the number of kids who are being abused, shaken baby syndrome. So, you're seeing this, right? This isn't just some statistical blip. This is a problem that's getting worse.
We've definitely seen an increase in the severity of cases, in the cases that have come to our office. As I said earlier, to have these three deaths in Chittenden County in the last 2 months, talking to somebody who's been in the office 20 years, they've never seen anything like that. So I think it's fair to say that we're seeing it as well.
Talk to me about DCF. There was a Department of Children and Families. There was a caseworker who recently testified in the legislature who I thought was quite eloquent talking about the problem of burnout and veterans staying on and then having to pick up even larger cases, new people coming in that you can't give a full load. I mean, is it in your observation, is DCF just totally overwhelmed or what?
I think DCF has an incredibly difficult job. And I think, like many areas of state government, they are overworked and understaffed. And the commitment here has to be, and I think Governor Shumlin has made this commitment to add more personnel to DCF. And we also have to do a couple things, Mark. And I'm not sure the answer is to wait for the call to be made. It's really about, again, prevention and intervention, getting out to the at-risk people in this community who have children. And let's put political correctness to the side. We know who they are. Let's go out and talk to them, make sure they get the services they need. We can make it voluntary so they have all the opportunity to get healthy. I don't think there's a parent in the world who wants to intentionally harm their child, but let's make sure that the services are available not only for the parent but for the child so we have healthy families and healthy kids growing up. I gotta tell you, I do disagree with Attorney General Sorrell's point of making the hearings in juvenile court public, because here's the thing, Mark, this is why I disagree with it. I'm not sure we're going to get a better outcome by having public scrutiny where terrible, traumatic things have happened to two-year-olds and three-year-olds who may not really understand what's happening. We make that a public record. What do you think happens to that three-year-old when they're now a 12-year-old on the playground?
Mm-hmm.
But when we're talking about sexual assault, we're talking about physical abuse from a parent. We make that a public record. You don't think we're going to re-traumatize that child? How about we get professionals who do their job, we give them resources, we give them adequate training, and we make sure that they get their job done. Let's make sure we have the resources done in the community to best protect our child. To open this up to public scrutiny in a way to say, well, if we got more eyes watching, we're going to have a better outcome. Everybody in the court system is trying to do the right thing. Are mistakes made? Absolutely. But they're not intentional mistakes. And I do think, you know, staffing and resources are part of it. But to suggest that if we just make it public, everything's going to be better, I think we're really opening up a can of worms and really doing more harm to the victims of these cases than good, because, you know, a playground and a school can be often a very intimidating place. And when you're a victim and some of the most intimate details of your life are being released, I'm not sure that's a good step to take.
Yeah, but wouldn't the victim not be identified or initials, you know, the way
you know,
it's usually done?
We do initials as best we can, Mark, but when you get into court, there's no initials.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there may be initials for children, but not for the parent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and you know, as much as this system tries to protect the victim's identity, you know, there is due process. You have the right to confront the witnesses against you.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it's going to take a rocket scientist to figure out who's who in some of these proceedings.
Right.
I mean, it happens today, even in a confidential proceeding. So, you know, I know everybody's trying to do the right thing and come up with solutions here. I'm not sure the solution, frankly, rests in the criminal justice system. If you're waiting for us to get involved, we only get involved when something bad happens. It's got to come much earlier in the process. Again, we have to build that coalition. We need that earlier reporting. We need more reporting. And we have to deploy services out to the families at risk in this community and give them services to take care of not only their problems, but to protect their kids. That's what's in the best interest of children in Vermont and families, in my opinion.
So people should report them to DCF. How about reporting them to you? I can hear some people saying, "Well, why aren't these cases being criminally prosecuted if you got a mother who's on heroin?"
Well, I'm not sure I understand that question.
If the mother would root
it back to the investigating agency, whether it's Coosie or which DCF is part of in Chittenden County.
No, you were saying that you'd like to see people reporting somebody if they saw them using drugs while they're pregnant.
Sure.
And you're saying DCF. I'm wondering, some people out there are probably saying, why not refer it to you?
Yeah. You know, if they did, and the call came in and said, let's assume the charge is mom has possession of a drug and is pregnant. What I would do is exactly what I'm suggesting, even in the criminal realm, is make services available for mom to make sure that she can find sobriety, has good parenting skills and techniques available, and to make sure that resources available as she nears her due date, and to make sure that the child is soft. The larger issue, frankly, Mark, is, you know, is this parent going to be competent, for lack of a better word, in order to parent her child? If they're not, then obviously we're going to have a formal DCF case where there will be proceedings, not only what's called a chin proceeding, but ultimately, and this raises another large issue in this state, Mark, what is called a TPR hearing, which is termination of parental rights. And the question that is certainly being debated in my office, and I'm sure other places, is somebody who is drug addicted, should they lose their parental rights to their children? You know, I think, and I've heard other stats thrown around in this state that, and I'm not sure they're accurate, but I'll put it out there in the context of this conversation, that Vermont has one of the highest rates of TPRs for children 0 to 2, and mostly it's driven from drug addiction. And that cuts both ways, in my opinion. Yes, we want to protect kids, absolutely. But there are many people who have suffered from addiction, whether it be from alcohol or other drugs, who have found sobriety and have been excellent parents. And we need to make sure that we're not just going aggressively against women because of their status as opiate addicts. I think it's a much more complicated issue. I think there's issues of fairness, of poverty that play a role here. And there is something to be said that of being raised by your biological parents. You know, and I think, again, it really has to be balanced. It's got to be fair, and we got to take all the factors into account. You know, on the other hand, hey, look, if you demonstrate that you can't take care of your child and you're putting your child at risk, it's probably in the state's interest to terminate your parental rights. So that is an incredibly hard conversation to have. Again, but my sense is when we're dealing with parents who are suffering from a disease that can be mitigated, that can be put in remission, well, then we need to kind of take a step back and say, are we treating the heroin addict differently than we are, say, an alcoholic?
Yeah, boy, I didn't even think of that. You know, I mean, that's so true. I mean, how many parents? Well, let me take one call here, let you go.
Yep.
Let's go to water break. Chris, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mark. Good morning to your guest.
Good morning.
You were just speaking about drug addicts and poverty.
Yep.
My question, I guess, is there a connection between drug addicts and people on welfare? And if so, as part of some form of heading off this possible problem, could there be a requirement to have a drug test before you receive any assistance from the state, being that you would probably, when you fill out the paperwork, I don't know anything about it, but if you fill out the paperwork applying for assistance, there's a pretty good chance that you have to also include your children as part of that paperwork, and I just didn't know if you could get some indication through a drug test for assistance, if you could maybe put the two together and catch some of this before it gets too far out of hand.
All right. Sure. Thanks, Chris.
You know, I don't know how I feel about taking away somebody's benefits, again, because of their status as being addicted. The larger question of the correlation between poverty and drug addiction, I would say this, Mark, that we know that addiction, like mental illness, does not discriminate. It touches everybody, and it crosses socioeconomic lines. But again, what kind of does discriminate is this issue of poverty. You come from a family of resources, it's more likely that, number one, it's not just financial resources, too. It's intellectual resources. You come from a family of resources, you might be more likely to see a red flag in one of your family members' lives, and you're going to have the resource, particularly insurance coverage, to get help, to send somebody to treatment, whereas oftentimes for the poor, the treatment and the diagnosis comes from the criminal justice system. Lawyers and judges saying, I'm going to convict you, and as a condition of your probation, go get drug treatment. What we don't talk about is the collateral consequence of that criminal conviction, that we just convicted you as a thief, as a drug addict. Go get, as a condition of probation, we say, go get treatment. We don't talk about what that does to the individual, what that conviction does to the individual in the community. We don't talk about that. We don't really navigate the services out in the community very well for folks. And what we really don't talk about is that oftentimes when we're dealing with addiction in terms of heroin and opiates, which is such a devastating addiction, you know, that option of treatment comes 6 to 9 months after the incident in the community. You know, it just doesn't make sense. And so, again, there has to be this level of fairness when we're dealing with folks who are addicted to drugs in this community. It is a health crisis. It is a disease, and it should be treated as one. I'll just end with this story, Mark. I was at a meeting about a week or two ago, and we were in groups talking, and one individual was there, had a patch on, a nicotine patch, I guess. And he said, I haven't had a cigarette in, you know, 6 months. And everybody, wow, that's great. That's, you know, that's the best thing ever. How is that any different than giving a heroin addict maintenance medication such as Suboxone? It is the same philosophy of mitigation, of harm reduction, and giving somebody to block, giving somebody medicine to block their urge to use, whether it's a cigarette or heroin. Yeah. It's the same thing, but there's no stigma. There was no stigma attached to this gentleman who had the nicotine patch. And frankly, people congratulated him on his courage. It should be the same for people who are struggling with addiction, with opiates, that we need maintenance medication. We need it available. We have to build capacity in our communities. We need the medical professional on board with us more than they are in order to give people the same opportunity that we give others. And we should not stigmatize people based on their status.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll echo one thing you said before. If we can't protect kids, then we've completely failed.
Absolutely. Number one mission of government, protect the most vulnerable. Who is more vulnerable than our children?
Yeah, that and the elderly. You know, we're not doing a completely great job on that front either.
That's the next show.
Yeah. Thank you for your time this morning. Thanks for staying longer than I told you. I appreciate it, as you know.
Mark, thank you.
T.J. Donovan is the Chittenden County State's Attorney. John, I'm sorry I couldn't keep T.J. on any longer, but I'd be interested to know what you're thinking this morning anyway. Good morning, John.
Guys, I hope T.J. is still listening, but I think, you know, he's trying to draw a distinction between, you know, being addicted to opiates and cigarettes and even alcoholism. But we need to understand that tobacco and alcohol are legal, you know, substances. And as far as I remember, heroin's illegal. So as long as we kind of you know, play around the fringes here, we're never going to solve the problem. We need to make people understand this is harmful to your life, and it's illegal, and you can't do it.
So what are you suggesting? They get arrested, or what? I mean,
well,
like,
you know, I think, you know, I'm a healthcare professional, and I see women in their pregnancies, and I know when they're smoking. You know, they'll tell me, and a lot of times you can tell that, you know, maybe they're doing some other drugs as well, and the loss of parental rights, I think, should be used as a, you know, a deterrent. And people need to understand that, you know, it's for society's good that if you're not a fit parent, we don't want kids to be subject to whatever abuses they more likely are going to be have bestowed upon them.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about TJ's idea of reporting women that you might find in an examination while they're pregnant and you find that they're using drugs?
Well, you know, I would leave that up to the healthcare professionals, you know, as far as the clinicians, the nurse practitioners. I think they need to use their judgment. Is this going to be, you know, best for the child? Or, you know, I think we have a lot of, this seems to be a lot of focus on someone's self-esteem more than the safety of a child. And I think, you know, self-esteem should take a back seat to safety.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they go hand in hand. I think when you have very low self-esteem that you're more inclined to reach, that your threshold is lower than it might be otherwise. That was the only reason I was bringing that in. But
I think the lack of a two-parent family tends to be a big factor as well in all these cases. And I know boyfriends don't have as much care for a child as the actual dad would.
Mm-hmm.
And that really needs to be looked at as well.
Yeah, and I mean, just, you know, having two as opposed to one, you know, I really don't know how people raise a child by themselves. I want to go back to one other point you made, though. The distinction between cigarettes, alcohol, and heroin. I hear you that cigarettes and alcohol are legal. And I don't think, I mean, you could argue that you shouldn't smoke while you're pregnant, that maybe, quote unquote, that's, you know, abusing a child. But people that smoke cigarettes don't get violent and hit their kids. But people that use alcohol, I would argue, are more likely to be violent towards other people than people that are on heroin.
That's always a possibility. But, you know, when you think about, you know, if you look at heroin as a high, and alcohol is a high, every high has an equal low. And when you're coming down from a high, you need your sleep or rest or, you know, shut eye. When there's a crying baby in the other room, that's when you try to do whatever your irrational mind tells you to do to get that baby to be quiet.
Yeah, that's fair. I agree with you on that. I think that's true. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it.
All right, great talking to you.
You too. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free, 877-291-8255. Guess we're not living in just a land of maple syrup, red barns, and rolling hills. Wow. This is very, very troubling. I have to tell you, this really troubles me, and I think it's a topic that, you know, I and others ought to spend more time talking about, even though I know it's uncomfortable to listen to, and some of this you'd rather just close your eyes and will it away. But, I mean, the numbers are just, they're really pretty staggering, to tell you the truth. 244-1777 is our local number. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let me just give you a couple of numbers here from Laura Kratz's story for Digger. Number of alleged child abuse or neglect cases filed in courts across Vermont last year grew 21% from the year before. Wow. I mean, that's just phenomenal. And this is fiscal year, so it's the fiscal year sort of the 2014 ended June 30th. So this is looking back. They do the year that way. You got what I meant. All right, let's go back to the phone here. Kevin, good morning. How are you?
Morning. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
I think we still have to talk about decriminalizing this stuff and putting it on the medical community. Not so much legalizing it as decriminalizing it and treat it as it is. Right now, we've got so many young men in prisons in this country, and it's more black issue. We're getting a touch on it up here right now because of the Oxycontin scenario the young men in this area, young women in this area, went to the heroin because they disabled the Oxycontin.
Right.
Now they're in the systems. And you put them in the systems, you take away the building blocks of society from them. They become a dependence of the state, basically. And once you institutionalize them and they don't come out of this, and most of these cases are going to be 5 years on some of these. Once you've got them there, that's it. They're in the system. You're probably not going to institutionalize them. They'll never be self-sufficient. We need to get people self-sufficient, be able to manage their cravings. And I disagree with the DA on the Suboxone. I think that's just a substitute for it. It needs to be a long-term program that desensitizes you to the high. We've got so many kids across this country, and we're going to lose our country if we don't get a grip on this. It's just not simply throw them in jail. Mm-hmm. People got to get a grip on it. I don't care how many parents you got in the house.
Okay, but if you decriminalize this and you make it more of a health issue the way you're describing, so how do you get people off of this drug other than these replacement drugs, just like the nicotine patch example?
Well, when somebody realizes they can't keep this going, you know, and the money is taken out of it, because it's coming here because of the money. It'll stop coming if there's no money involved in it. The drug won't come. It should be managed by a medical situation. Now, okay. Let's say you are hooked,
yep.
And right now, it's going to take a while out. Just like it's going to take a while to get people out of cigarettes, you know, it's going to take a while to get them out of this stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to have to be done, you know, through clear eyes of, you know, the people in power. And you've got too many people that are making money on this, not just in the criminal end of it, but in this enforcement of it, that you're going to have to get out. It is a small industry. When you look at what goes on to keep you out of this and put you into it, there's a lot of money on both sides of the equation.
Yep.
It's going to be, you know, if you don't, it is a mental health issue. It is a mental health issue. And if you don't control that end of it, there's a chief of police out in Seattle that's dealing with this. He's been in the business for 30 years. He's finally thrown up his hands and says, you know, this isn't working. We need to turn this around in a different way.
Yeah.
And we need to be looking at it. And we got the feds involved in this up here. We don't really have our state involved in it up here. The feds are involved in it. And they're gonna slam you away for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can't control yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Let's back to the phone. Christopher, good morning. How are you?
Good. Yourself?
Not too bad. Thanks.
Hi. My name is Christopher. I grew up in this area in central Vermont, and firsthand I dealt with addiction. And really how it all started was, you know, a few mental health issues. And then basically our proximity to the cities are so close that we are almost helpless up here without help. And they've done studies in Switzerland and everywhere else on the Suboxone program. And the Suboxone program has helped, and it gives an avenue in what the state's attorney saying that you get stuck in the judicial system, and it's true, and then you're labeled as a criminal. And if you would have help soon enough, if you could get help soon enough, then you could eliminate the years of resentment that you're going to have towards the state and the judicial system.
So did you break your addiction or not?
Yes, by going through the Suboxone program. Now I'm actually going to school to receive a certificate in substance abuse treatment to help these people that have gone through the same thing. Because if you don't get help soon enough, then you can destroy your life to an extent where you can't come back from it.
Mm-hmm. How deep did you get?
Oh, terribly. I lost my entire family, and I had to work back towards to get all that back. And so now I'm working with people to try to set up a program to get people help sooner. And basically, the entire state is understaffed as far as it goes for helping people with addiction. So the state in a whole needs to be self-sufficient and provide help sooner to these people than later.
Mm-hmm. Are you still taking the Suboxone? Is that like a forever thing, or how does that work?
No, they slowly take you. take you down off from it through group therapy. And yeah, it does. It gives you hope and a crutch to want to stay away from the street level drug of it.
Right. And are you don't have to answer this. You don't have to answer anything I ask you, but I'm just curious. Are you dealing with the underlying mental health stuff too?
Yeah, that was actually dealt with through a residential treatment facility, and they dealt with that first. And then once they dealt with the mental health part of it, then we dealt with the addiction part. And then now I'm actually involved in helping people that are going through the same issues. And we're working on a thing with where, like, basically people that are suffering with addiction, you know, we could be involving them in programs with providing food for low-income housing in our community, anything that can basically make these people feel like they have something to live for rather than themselves. Because the addiction is so strong that you do not feel like you have anything to live for.
Yep. How are you coping on a daily basis? Is it a challenge, or are you kind of over it?
The challenge is seeing all the other people still suffering, not getting help. And like I said, like the state is so, our state is so ill-prepared to deal with this problem. And there's so many people against helping people. They just think that people can just stop. Well, it is a physically demanding addiction. And once you're involved in this addiction, you can't just say, oh, if I lose this, then I'm going to stop. Because you're not going to stop. You're willing to lose everything.
Yep. Thank you.
You have a rational mind.
Yeah. I'm grateful you called. Thank you. It took some courage, and I think it was helpful for other people to hear. Thank you.
Yep. Appreciate it. No problem.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Moment of your time for our friends at Green Mountain Access. If you're looking for a great local internet service provider, make it our friends at gmavt.net. You can call them toll-free 1-888-321-0815. On the web, gmavt.net. Division of Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom. Speak with them about combining those services, television, telephone, and internet, all into one handy-dandy affordable package if you happen to be in that service area. If you want to get more information about the services they provide in addition to their outstanding webmail, they can host your website, for example. Lots of other services available, too. Check it all out at gmavt.net, and then pick up the phone and call them at 1-888-321-0815.
Hi, I'm Dan Feliciano, a write-in candidate for governor.